who graded. Sorry for the delay. Part of it was intentional because the TAs had their own exam, and then part of it was unintentional, but they got ungraded and realized they graded something incorrectly and had to go back and fix something. So, at any rate, the mean was 74, so I think that was pretty good. And I've posted the distribution and the solutions, and I'll let you pick them up in class. Next on the agenda, though, is we will have exam 3 1 week from now in this room, and I list all the stuff that is on it. It's basically through electromagnetic waves excluding polarization. And then I have requested a room on Tuesday for a Q&A session, which I'll give you the information as soon as I have it. The formula sheet that you have, you're welcome to write anything you want on one side and make a half out of a minute sheet of paper, same as last time. So the drill is pretty much the same. Any questions? Okay. So we started into optics last time, and as I say, these rules can really be extracted from Maxwell's equations, which is another reason to believe that in fact Maxwell's equations are describing the phenomenon of light. But I'm going to spare you that ordeal and spend the time actually talking about optics a little bit more practically speaking. So last time we talked a little bit about optics. One of the things that's very important to realize is that when light travels through a substance, that it's transparent, so it can go through. It may travel, and typically will travel, at a velocity that is less than what it has in a vacuum. We reserve the letter C for the speed of light in a vacuum, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. We, of course, use C for lots of other things, like heat, specific heats and things like that, but nevertheless, in optics, we reserve for the speed of light in a vacuum. And the velocity, typically inside a material, is going to be slower. So C over B is a number that is greater than or equal to 1. We call it the index of refraction. So it's really a measure of the speed of light in a substance. And it turns out to be a key for many things. You can imagine if you have, imagine you're watching the St. Patrick's Day parade or something, and you have this marching band all going in formation, okay? And they come to a place where let's say that they come to an intersection, all right? And let's say that in the intersection . So here's your intersection, and here's your marching band coming down the street. And let's suppose that in this intersection, there's this huge, thick mud region that looks like that, okay? And these band members are all concentrating on their music, and they're paying no attention to what they're about to go through. So what's going to happen? Band members that are marching and they hit the mud, all of a sudden they're going to go slower, right? And so what you'll end up with happening is that effectively, let me blow it up a little bit. Here are the band members coming in, and then they hit a region of mud. And if you can imagine, these band members that are not in the mud yet continue on at the same velocity, these that are now in the mud slow down. So what will happen is the ones that are further over this way have slowed down earlier. So you'll end up with this wave of band members basically turning, and the distance between them will be reduced. A way to think about that is when this person slows down, this person's still walking, so the distance between those rows gets less. All right? That's what happens with light when it hits a substance where it moves slower than it does in a vacuum. If it comes in at an angle and you're going from low N to high N, so N2 is greater than N1, low N meaning it's like a vacuum right here, it's low, okay? Higher the N, the higher the N, the slower you are. If it comes in at an angle, it turns, and the wavelength is shortened by a factor of N. And we call this the incident angle, that is the angle you make. This is the interface, so you have like glass or water here, and you have air over here or something. The thing that's at 90 degrees to that, we call the normal to the surface. As the light comes in, this would be the incident angle, this would be the refracted angle. And the refracted angle is going to be smaller than the incident angle because of this weird effect. Okay? There might be a reflective ray, or let's suppose this is a mirror, if there is a reflective ray. For the reflective rays, you'll always have that the incident angle and the reflected angle are the same. If you're going from mud into good pavement, or you're going from glass into air, or water into air, you have an opposite effect, which is this angle is the angle of incidence, and the refracted angle over here is going to be larger. It's bent away from the normal. So the rule of thumb is going from low end to high end. When air is glass, you're bent toward the normal. Going from glass to air, or from high end to low end, you're bent away from the normal. Okay? Now you'll note some weirdness. If I increase this angle, so I'm coming in at more and more of an angle, this angle is getting bigger and bigger, and eventually this one is 90 degrees. At that very threshold, we define this angle of incidence coming in this way called the critical angle. And if you go any bigger than that, that is, if I come at any more of an angle here, I have total internal reflection, and you get nothing. Okay, so that's the basis for a lot of optics problems you may run into. The relationship between these angles, between the incident angle and the refracted angle, basically is given by this Snell's law, N1 being the index of refraction over here, sine theta 1 for that one, N2 sine theta 2 over here. You can vary the N's and you see how it's related to the angles. And okay, so those are sort of how light rays are when they hit an interface. The study of light is very rich in part because of how it interacts with materials. And one of the things that is both a fabulous advantage in using light for different things and an incredible disadvantage is the following thing that seems to be true, which is if we plot the index of refraction, which remember is C over V, versus the wavelength of the light, or if you want to think of frequency, frequency is really a better identifier for the light. That's the color, and that does not change when you go into different materials. Okay, so I'm going to put here lambda zero, meaning the frequency in a vacuum. V is equal to lambda times nu. So lambda and nu are inverses of each other, so that would mean that the frequency is increasing that way. Okay, so I'm basically plotting the color of the light. And what we find is that the index of refraction depends on the frequency of the light, where we would have red light or lower frequency over here, and we would have the blue light over on this side. So for most materials, then what you find is that the light is slower in the blue. The blue light is slower than red. Okay. This phenomenon is called dispersion. So what it tells you is that N depends on the frequency or the wavelength, if you want to think of it that way. Okay? So one of the ways in which this is a valuable asset is that you can use it to spectrum analyze the light. So let's imagine that we have white light coming in, which I'm going to use yellow. And then let's imagine that this hits a surface of glass that looks like this. And let's imagine what happens. This will be our normal. And then we know that the light, when it hits the glass at some angle to the normal, which was sort of the angle of incidence here, we know it gets bent toward the normal. But the problem is, so if we were to calculate, for example, the refracted angle, so let's imagine that I have some angle over here and I call this the theta r. I know that N air times the sine of theta I is equal to N glass times the sine of theta r, or N air over N glass times the sine of theta 1, I is equal to sine of theta r. So let's imagine for a moment that we're at angles less than 90 degrees, so you can we can even think small angles, so that you can think of the theta as basically being sine theta is equal basically to theta. But notice that the angle I get here depends on N in the glass. So if N in the glass is bigger, like it is for blue light, then this angle is going to be bigger. I'm sorry, smaller, right? Because if this is bigger, then this quantity is going to be smaller. So that's going to be smaller. If N is smaller, like it is for red light, then this is going to be bigger. Did I get that right? Right. So what that means is for red light, it is bent less than it is for blue light. And you'll have green light falling somewhere in between, and orange light, like so. So you decompose the white light, which is a mixture of many different frequencies, by the fact that at that interface, you get each of the frequencies to bend a little bit differently due to this dispersion. I hope, trust, that you've had a chance to play with these before. If you have a piece of glass like this, you call it a prism, you basically have the same effect on the other interface when it goes through, so that if you have a prism and you have white light incident, then you'll have some separation as you go into the glass, with blue being bent a little less than the red. I'm sorry, blue being bent a little more than the red. And then at the other interface, they're bent away from the normal, but it's going to be the same sort of thing. So imagine that we have this light now passing through. I'm going to redraw it as yellow again just because. Now I have this interface, and I have the light coming in. It's inside glass, and it hits that interface. And now the light gets bent away from the normal, but you'll have the same effect. That the light that is blue gets bent more, and it gets bent away from the normal. So the blue would come out like that, and the red less so. So you get further separation as you go through the other interface. So what happens is as you go through the prism, you get this separation of light into its various colors. Sort of like so. So if you're doing something that wants, where you need to measure how much light you have at certain frequencies, so a spectrometer or some form of chemistry or biology or physics, you name it, then you can spectrum analyze the light by using a prism. Okay, so there are better ways to do it. You can separate the light more if you use what's known as a refraction grating, and we'll talk about that probably next class. That makes use of something that's a little bit different, but the prism works pretty well. So this weird effect of the light, though, bending at interfaces, you can use to manipulate light quite nicely. If you imagine what would happen if I forget dispersion for the moment, and I have a piece of glass that looks like this, then if I have light that is incident here, at the first interface, it's going to be bent toward the normal, so it comes in like that. And at the second interface, it's bent away from the normal, so it comes out like that. Right? And on the other side, you have the same kind of effect. Didn't really mean to change colors here. But. So on the other side, you'll have light coming in. It's bent toward the normal. Then it's bent away from the normal. And I'm sure you know this is an optical lens, and so you can use this to manipulate the light if you want to think of it as rays. This would be the case if you have something like glass or water here and something like air here. The main thing being that you have in outside and in inside, and in is greater than in out. This causes rays of light, if you want to think of them that way. Light that's coming in here and light that's coming here are converging to a point. So a lens that is designed like this, where you're thicker in the middle than you are on the edges, is known as a converging lens. And all of this gets reversed if I have a lens that is thicker on the outside than on the inside. In that case, what you'll find is that the light rays diverge for exactly the same reasons. And this would be known as a diverging lens. You okay with that? Any questions? Okay, now we talked about dispersion already, so let me just give you a sense of it. I have a lot more thin lens stuff that we'll talk about. But imagine that I have this lens, and we've already discussed the fact that in the real world, that the blue light is bent more than the red light. So if the lens is there and it's converging the light, and you have white light coming in, for example, so the lens on the camera, you're trying to take a picture, one of the things that will happen is that the blue light rays will meet at a point that's different from the red light rays. So quite literally, the effect that the lens has on the light depends on the wavelength of the color. And that will create an aberration in your picture. This particular aberration of the lens is called a chromatic aberration. And you can correct it out with very special combinations of lenses that effectively will counterbalance this effect. And if you have friends who are in optical engineering, they all have to sweat through a class in lens design, and you may see them looking at long combinations of lenses and doing simulations and things like that. But basically they're trying to reach certain specs for instruments to reduce aberrations of different sorts. So I'll talk a bit more about different aberrations in a moment. But any questions on this so far? Okay, so with an apology, I would like to take you on a tour of, basically most of it would be talking about thin lenses and optical instruments. Thin lenses are lenses where the size of them is basically small compared to the distance, which is what we would call the focal length. And you really don't worry about the size of the lens per se itself. The focal length would be the distance. If I had light coming in parallel lines, it'd be the distance where all of these rays would meet, basically. And you can have lenses that are much thicker than that, and you may need them if you're an optical engineer. We're not going to worry about those. But thin lenses, you need to get pretty good at. These drawings, as you can see already, are painful to do. And so I'm actually going to use pre-prepared slides for this. So I'm sorry, but they will be posted. And I don't know what to say, but it also allowed me to pull in some interesting pictures and stuff. So I just want to talk about thin lenses now. And so this you've already seen. There's a certain kind of, there's some language that we want to use here. If I have a source that's very, very far away, then, as we've already talked about, at the source, you may have the light coming out in the spherical wavefront. If you're very, very far away, when you see that wavefront, it looks completely flat coming at you. Okay? So the way that you can imagine when you start thinking about thin lenses is you no longer really think of this wave so much coming in, but you think of it as a bunch of parallel rays of light coming in. And if the source is at infinity, even though it may be a point source, you don't see the spherical wavefront, so all of these rays are coming in parallel to the axis of this lens that I put in place. Different ways to say it. If they say source at infinity, it means the rays are coming in parallel. If they say the light is coming from infinity, they mean parallel. Different ways of saying the same thing. Okay, so if these rays are coming in from infinity parallel, and I have a converging lens here, as we mentioned, it will cause these rays of light to converge at a point, and that point is what we define as the focal length. You can consider this lens as having a focal length to each side. This distance and that distance are the same. This would be the center line of the lens. Okay? A little bit of language here. A lens that's thicker in the middle than on the outside, you call a convex lens, and that's a converging lens. There's a way to remember it. There's another type of lens we'll talk about, the ones that diverge. They're called concave lenses. There's a way to remember in your head which is concave and which is convex. I'll tell you that in just a moment. For now, this is a convex lens. Note that this lens is thicker in the middle than on the outside, so it'll be a converging lens even though it has this odd shape. Okay. And one of the things that you will have to do is to try to figure out what a lens with a certain focal length will do to the light that you see. And so, again, one way to do that is graphically. And so graphically, what you imagine is that somewhere out here is an object, which we always picture as an arrow. An arrow because it gives you a size and it gives you an orientation, and you have a distance. Okay, this distance is called the object distance because it's the object that you're observing. And let's imagine what happens to rays of light that all emanate from the tip of this arrow. A ray that comes in from infinity, which is a different way of saying it is parallel to this center line, is bent by this lens and it goes through the focal point, by definition of the focal point. A ray of light that goes straight through, actually, even though it's hard to tell from the drawing and it's not drawn quite perfectly, hits each interface at 90 degrees, and so there's no change in its angle, so that goes straight through. And then a ray of light that goes through the focal point on the other side is bent in a converging way, but it isn't bent so that it comes out parallel to this line. Okay, so those are sort of the three rays that you can think your way through when you're doing, we call this ray tracing in geometric optics. Where these three rays that are leaving this point meet is the point where you get what's called an image. It is the place where this lens will recreate sort of the picture of what that is. If I were to put a piece of paper right here, I would see a picture of that arrow, and it would be, you know, this size, and it would be inverted. Inverted meaning it is pointing in a direction opposite from what it was on the other side of the lens. Okay? How many of you have burned ants with lenses? The cruel ones are out front. And the rest of you are probably lying, because everybody's done this. I think if you have a lens, it's almost, it's
hard to not.
You have to use a converging lens, right? Because what you're doing is you're taking lens and light is coming in from the larger area and converging it to a point. The point that you're trying to use to burn the ant, that is where it gets brightest, that is where all that light can give, that's the focal point for the lens. Okay. So, for those of you who've done that, then that is a nice graphic way of remembering what the focal point here. Okay, so if you have a diverging lens, it has sort of the opposite effect. It is thinner in the middle, and that means that rays of light coming from infinity are made to diverge from each other, and the way to figure out how that happens is that if they're coming in from infinity, as they go through this, they go off at an angle such that if you were to extrapolate it back, it would go through the focal point on the other side of the lens. Okay? I mentioned that converging lenses are also called convex lenses. Lenses that are diverging or thinner in the middle are called concave lenses. This is a completely stupid way to remember it, but I'm embarrassed to tell you it's exactly how I remember which is which. And that is, if you look at a concave lens, you have a little cave. Okay? Totally works. Convex, you've got no cave. So you look at it and you pick the one that's got the cave and you know that's the concave lens and the other one is the convex lens. It may sound a little bit funny because this lens is making the rays go away. It's a diverging lens, but it still has a focal length and it still has a power, right? So if this is a stronger lens, these diverge more and the focal length is shorter. So if you have a diverging lens, it's a little harder to imagine what's going on in some ways, but we do the ray tracing in exactly the same sort of way. A ray coming in from infinity is kicked out in a direction such that when you extrapolate it back, it goes through the focal point. A ray that's headed straight through the center of the lens is unchanged. And a ray that is headed toward the focal point on the other side diverges, but it is basically kicked out to go toward infinity over here. It comes out parallel. If you take those three rays, the straight through ray, the one that is straight through kicked out so that it extrapolates back to the focus, and then the one that is coming in toward the focus and comes straight out, you extrapolate those three rays backwards, you get the image for this lens. Now, it may seem a little bit odd because you say, what do you mean when you say image here? If I put a piece of paper right here, nothing's going through the lens. So I can't image this per se. Okay? It is not the same. However, what does it really mean? It means that if I put my eyeball over here, okay, what I see when I look at this thing through this lens is this. It is smaller, it is not inverted, and if I were to visually measure the distance in a sense, it would be here instead of there. That's what you mean when you say you form the image. How does that work? These light rays are bent in such a way that to your bare eye, it looks as if the lens weren't there, this would be the thing you're looking at. Okay? That's how it looks through the lens. That's what you mean by image for it. Well, for anything. Okay? We can measure the lenses, we call power and diopters would be 1 over the focal length in meters. This is a pretty typical measure of the power of a lens that you'll see in your optometrist's office and stuff. They'll often talk about the power in terms of diopters. It is a positive number if it's for a converging lens. It is a negative number if it's for a diverging. Magnification is sort of a straightforward thing in the sense that what we really are talking about is if I start with something of a certain height, how big does it seem compared to what it started with? So if you are able to figure out, or you're given the heights of the object in the image, or you're able to graphically figure it out using sort of the rules that we just said, then the magnification really is defined as the height that you end up with over the height that you start with. It turns out that if you look at similar triangles, that will also be DI over DO. There's a minus sign thrown in here because we're about to get into conventions of lots of things in terms of honestly don't remember why you don't have a minus sign here. I was about to say the minus sign basically is telling you that it's inverted, which I think is true. I guess the H's here must carry the negative sign for these to be consistent. Anyway, so you'll end up with a negative number if it's inverted as opposed to upright. Now, you can literally take information that's given to you that's describing a thin lens, and you can take a piece of graph paper and sketch it out and actually draw these rays appropriately and end up with something that's pretty close to what you'll get. We will not do much of that. If you can imagine, that'd be a lot of fun to grade. We will mostly do it more analytically, and so there is an analytical equation that we use to describe thin lenses, and that is using this equation. This is 1 over the distance from the middle of the lens to the object plus 1 over the distance to the image is equal to 1 over the focal length. Write it on your formula sheet. That's the easy part. The formula is basically trivial. It's all in the signs and the conventions, and that's where this becomes a bit touchy. Just another thing I wanted to note, though. You can have magnification even if you have this diverging lens, right? Because if you put your eyeball over here, this thing's going to look smaller. So there's a measure. And again, here the H's are all pointed up. And then we're going to have to worry about the conventions of these signs to make sure you hit magnification with the correct sign and know that it's upright instead of inverted. So here are conventions, and you'll find them in Gene Coley. I can read them for you. It's sort of pointless. This is not something you get by me spouting it off at you. It's something you get by looking at the problem, looking at the conventions, and figuring it out yourself, because I can't do much for you. But it basically, we call the focal length is positive for converging, negative for diverging. There's a general rule is if the object distance is positive, if it's on the side of the lens that the light is coming from, and that is always the case if you have a single lens system, but as we'll show you, that's not at all the case when you have multiple lenses necessarily. The image distance, so you have this typical case, I have a converging lens, I have an object over here, I'll put an image over here. In that case, the object distance is positive, and it's sort of a very conventional case, so I would call the image distance positive in that case. Image distance is positive for so-called real images and negative for virtual images. Okay, what do I mean by that? A real image is one where you could put a piece of paper and form an image on that piece of paper. A virtual image is one where I can't put the piece of paper and form the image, like that diverging lens we saw a moment ago. However, if I put my eyeball on the other side of the lens, I would see this thing. It's not that there's not an image there, it's just not one that I can have light pass through, focus on a piece of paper. So there is a difference in those types of images. We call the height of the image positive if it is in the same direction as the object was, and if it's inverted, you would make it negative. So like I say, there are lots of conventions, a little bit like Kirchhoff's law. It's not going to make a lot of sense right now until you go through it, if you've done it. I think one thing I do want to make a point of, though, maybe I can choose a better color here. Imagine I have a lens and I have some object over here, and I get some image right here. Okay? I can put a piece of paper right here. That would be a real, and it's not drawn very well, inverted image. Okay. Suppose I have two lenses. Suppose I have a lens here and some other lens here. Now, the way that you do this is that the image of this lens is the object of that lens. That is, the rays of light coming through the first lens are acting like they're coming from that image of the first lens, wherever it is. So when you go through the second lens, that image of the first lens is the object for the second lens. And it could be anywhere, depending on what's going on with that first lens. So this lens could create an image that's way over here. That might be the object then. That is the object for this lens. And this would be a case, for example, I might have two converging lenses, and we said if I have something over here, this would be defined as a positive distance. In this case, for example, the object for this lens is now over here, and its object distance would be negative. Okay, so it's sort of weird. So when you get into the multiple lens systems, you really have to keep track of where things are and what your conventions are. I'm probably going to do a little bit more with that later, but I just wanted to mention it now. Whether you like it or not, thin lenses are really near and dear to you because they enable you to see. You have this cool device called the eye, and it has a nice lens, and you have muscles here that can actually change this thickness, and that adjusts the focal length of this lens, which is how you can focus on different things. And if your ability to change that lens is not quite perfect, that is, either you... Well, so that the changes here don't really match the back of your eyeball. What you'd like to have is to have the image focused on the back of the eye where you have sensors that pick it up. If it focuses a little bit early, that is, if this lens is a little strong, then in fact what that means is that you are able to see things that are near to you, but you have a much harder time for things that are far away. And the way to fix that is to put a diverging lens, which effectively takes this too short focal length and makes it a little bit longer to focus on the back of your eye. If you are farsighted, you want to do the opposite. It's focusing back behind your eye, and you put in a lens that will cause it to focus on the eye. So you can actually tell if you look at somebody's glasses, which they are. If they have like the Coke bottle lenses, okay, then they're farsighted. They look like Coke bottle lenses because they're very thick here and thin there. But if they are very nearsighted, then it looks like they're carrying around, you know, these big thick things here. And trust me, I am not making fun of anybody with glasses because I wore them my whole life until I had LASIK about 6 or 7 years ago. And if you really want, I'll show you the video of the LASIK if you've never seen it. It's absolutely cool. You have any idea what LASIK? Okay, so just to make it, so in LASIK, instead of putting the corrective lens here, you slice the cornea right here, okay, and you take this flap and you pull it back like that. Literally, it's a flap. You don't cut it all the way. You leave it a little connected right here, okay. And so they cut it off. They don't cut it off. They just flip it back. And then they take a nice little laser and they burn tissue right here and shape the tissue a little bit. So if you need a little extra curvature, they will burn a little more over here and less in the middle. If you need a little less curvature, they'll burn a little more in the middle. So they quite literally, when they flip this flap back on and they've shaped the tissue underneath, the shape of this surface is different. And from that, they can change the strength of the effective combination of your lens and the surface of your eye. Yes?
So for people who get LASIK and then years and years later, they become nearsighted or farsighted again, is that because their eye...
Okay, so, yeah, well, while we're on the topic. If your doctor's good, okay, they'll run some checks on the thickness of your cornea.
Yeah.
Your cornea needs to be a certain thickness so that they actually can do this nicely. And if it's screwed up, they can flip it off again and try again to help correct. So that's one thing. Two is, if your doctor is a good doctor, they are not willing to do this until your eyes have stopped changing and everybody's eyes change. If you are a typical nearsighted person, your eyes will often just get worse or do some changing up until you're about 30, 35-ish. So your near vision sort of often, you have to go and get new glasses all the time. If they do LASIK before that stops changing, then you're right. They've corrected it, and you're going to end up wearing glasses again and correct your near vision. I hate to tell you this. You've seen it. You won't really appreciate it until you go to a party when you're about 43. It's really awful. But if you're out and about and you see somebody putting on reading glasses, I can guarantee you they're typically over 40. And there's nothing you can do. It pisses you off. All of a sudden, you're 42, you're happily going about your day, and all of a sudden you realize you can't read. And it'll hit you just like that once, and you're like, no, I can't. So, you do this. And you live in denial. So people in their early 40s living in denial are the ones who are doing this shit. And it's worse if the light is dim, so you'll see it a lot in restaurants, okay? And, okay, that or they're forgetful. So those of us that have reading glasses, they forget our reading glasses. They're also around, so you can see the moment the memories come, they'll start cursing because they can't see doodly squat. Okay, it's awful. So you lose your ability to, let's see, so that means you are basically farsighted. So you lose your ability to make this lens stronger. And so you that everybody gets it, and that's when you need 3D glasses. Okay? That gets worse as you get older, and there's nothing you can do about that. So typical LASIK is you wait till you're near, if you're nearsighted, you wait until your vision has stopped changing. Then you do LASIK and you correct for your far vision. You will still have your near vision get worse, so you'll still need reading glasses. Okay, there's not much you can do about that. So that's sort of typical, and that's how you get around that problem, but you're still, say, I'm stuck with reading glasses. When you're nearsighted, you can see things very close. So when my vision, when I was nearsighted, I avoided reading glasses because all I had to do was take my normal glasses off and I could see things here just fine. Okay, because I was very nearsighted. But then the day I had LASIK, the next morning when I woke up, I couldn't see anything close. I had my reading glasses immediately. So that was really cool. I've not been able to see for my entire life. Because this is not, I mean, it's invasive, but not super invasive. So you wake up the next day, and you open your eyes, that you're basically sleeping that one day away, so you don't notice it coming, you don't really notice it the day before. You wake up the next morning and you look out and you're seeing the outline of bricks on houses that are, five down. That's just amazing. It's so cool. Alright, so if you're ever going to do LASIK, and the technology may change, there's some really cool stuff doing R&D here where they're actually using lasers that damage the cornea in the middle of the cornea, focuses in the light and creates scar tissue in the middle of the cornea, causing the cornea to distort in such a way that you might be able to make correct vision. So there's really cool technologies that are out there, so you may never have to face this, but if you do have LASIK, I have two absolutely cool pieces of advice or information for you. One is, if you do it, you should schedule your surgery for early December. Why? They slice your cornea. All they do is lay it back on your eye and smooth it out. There's no sewing. It sort of sticks. They do that and then they tell you, don't rub your eye for a week. Yeah. And you sleep in these funky Superman goggles or something, some sort of, you know, Superfly goggles, so that you can't do that at night. And you can horrify your kids by going out in public with them on. So they're really good for years in that way. But now, what happens is you really seriously damage it. And as you know, if you have something that's been damaged, when you get tired, it swells, right? So what happens when you have LASIK later in the day for about 6 weeks, 8 weeks or something, your cornea swells a bit, and that will cause point-like sources of light to sort of blur out. And you get quite uncomfortable a bit in the evenings. Okay, it's not too bad, but it makes Christmas lights spectacular. If I could invent a pill that you could take that would give you that vision, it'd be really cool. They do make these little glasses to get the little blue things out. So So LASIK on December is a cool thing to do. The other thing that they never tell you about that you don't notice until you're actually there is they take it, they touch your eye a little bit. Now, when they do that, you can't see anything. They'll give you a little red dot that you're supposed to finish. They don't move your eye while they're hitting it with a laser. And, you know, you're scared of that. Of course, your eye is moving a little bit, so there's a lot of technology they have that moves enough. They stop the laser. And, you know, they try to track it and everything. So it's really cool in terms of its technology. The thing that they don't tell you about is when they hit you with a laser, you smell yourself burning. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, that. And so, you know, all of a sudden they start and you're like... And you're afraid to go, ooh, because you're afraid your eye will move. It's really awful. Okay, so different aberrations. We talked about chromatic aberration, where the red and the blue are focused at different points. You also can have spherical aberration, where in a lens, the focal length can depend on where you are in terms of radius, which basically will also distort the image a lot. Okay? And so there are many different types of aberrations. Your eyeball can also have some of these aberrations. So it's not just nearsighted or farsightedness, but in fact you can have all sorts of strange focal length aberrations on the back of, you know, with your lens. And so when they say you have astigmatism, you can have some effective angular dependence on what the focal length is. And there are very high order, by high order I mean as a function of angle as you go around, you can have a lot of variability in what it is. So I went back to Scott the Great here in New York because he was using a device that used a small laser and was literally correcting out higher order aberrations in the lens, which I thought... I'm a geek, so I thought that was sort of cool. So I went and I got it, but it also means that I can see a little bit at 2015. I can see a lot at 2015, but I can even see sometimes at 2010 with my eyes. 2020 would be normal. Meaning I'm not sure what, but I'm sure some of you do. But okay. Your eye is an optical instrument. If we take this thin little region of the electromagnetic spectrum and blow it up, visible light has a wavelength ranging from about 400 nanometers up to almost 800 nanometers. The center is in the green region. If we look at the relative sensitivity of a typical eyeball, your sensitivity peaks in the green. All right, so as you go to far blue and far red, you cannot see it. One of the things that's sort of neat is that how you perceive the light very much depends on the convolution of the light source with your sensitivity curve. So if we look at different sources, this would be a spectrum for typical daylight, which matches pretty well what your eye sensitivity is. Probably there's a good reason for that, right? Incandescent lamps look more like this. fluorescent lamps, more like that. Fluorescent lamps often seem cold or blue. And nowadays in LED, and I don't have a curve like this, but you can go to the store and you can buy warm or hot LEDs or cool things. When you talk about something being cool, its source is a little bit over to the blue. It just seems, we perceive it as cold. If it's warm, then its source is a little bit more to the red, and you perceive it as being yellow or red and a bit warmer. Okay? Which is really sort of funny, because when we talk about the energy that's carried by the photon than the light, you have more energy for the blue, so it's definitely hotter than the red. But you know, if you take an iron poker and you put it in the fire, it starts out red, and then as you warm it up, it gets bluer and everything. So in fact, we're a little bit backwards that way, but that's what you mean if you go to Home Depot. There are lots of different types of eyes. Some of them are not really, this is ours, and it's fairly complicated. These, there are much simpler things where you just have light-sensitive things in some segments. There are ways to image things just using a pinhole. And then there are compound eyes where you have lots and lots of segments. So you guys are probably pretty familiar with a lot of these things. But here, for example, is a dragonfly head, and it has an eyeball that looks something like this. One of the things that's sort of cool is if you know optics and how these things work, you can actually create what you think they should be seeing, whatever they are. So if you have this image as your person, this is what a bee would see, which is sort of fun. Again, for good reason. The resolution, that is the ability to resolve two different objects, if they're very close together, then the angle of the light rays coming in is smaller, okay? So what you want, if you have you say that you have the ability to resolve small angles or have high resolution, means that you can resolve two things that are close together a distance apart. If you plot basically a measure of that angular resolution, which is getting smaller, so better resolution as you go down here, versus body height, things that have evolved where if you're tall like a human, you need to worry about what it is you're about to step on. So you have to have an eyeball that can resolve things down at the ground pretty nicely. So we need pretty good eyes. The same thing is true for a peregrine falcon. So our resolutions are really quite good. Okay. If you are close to the ground, so something like fruit fly may or may not be close to the ground, but if you're a spider or whatever, you're up here. Your eye resolution is not so great. You're also a smaller object. If you're on the ground or whatever, you don't need that kind of eyeball. So it's sort of cool that nature gives you sort of what you need.
No surprise to most of you.
If you are an animal that likes to work in the dark, then you get eyeballs, the holes get really big. You have to let in a lot of light. Okay, that can affect your resolution. We'll talk about that in a moment for a camera. The coolest eyeball I know of, personally, would be that of this minnow that has an eyeball designed so that it works simultaneously to see up above and to see down below. It's a total Dr. Seuss thing. So here's the water level. The index of refraction here and here is different. So if you're going to image it, right, you need different power lenses. And the eyeball is designed so that you can get an image over here of what's going on down in the water very nicely, and an image over here of what's going on above the water very nicely. Now, is that a cool eye? So, okay, so magnifying glasses. These are very useful for many things. One of the things you can use them for is as the final piece for an optical instrument like a telescope or a microscope. And you'll do a lot of problems. I mean, the way to get it is, I'm talking about a lot of stuff right now, a lot of pretty pictures. I hope you're enjoying it at some point. In the end, I'm going to assign a crap load of optics problems for you, and that's where you figure out how to actually do. There are a lot of subtleties that come up, and one of the things will be what power lens do you use, etc., and how do you figure out these things. So there's one rule of thumb that's going to always be pretty useful for you, and that is we consider the near point for a normal eye to be 25 centimeters. What do I mean by a near point? A near point is the closest point that your eye can comfortably focus. So if you start with your finger out here and you focus on it, you can see it pretty well, and as you move it in, you'll lose focus at some point. That distance for an average normal human eye is 25 centimeters. Whether it is for you or not is irrelevant. That's what we call the near point for the human eye for all of the calculations. So what you would like to do is effectively take the device and put it at or close to the near point. Let me back away from that. Some of that is going to be problem specific to make sense of it. So let me back away from that. So a magnifying glass is sort of the following thing. You have an object and you look at what happens to the rays, and it effectively gives you an image that's much bigger. Okay, using this type of drawing. So here, it is a converging lens, but you are inside the focal length, so you'll end up diverging these rays a little bit. It'll give you an image that seems much bigger. That image is, your eye is most comfortable if those rays seem to come in from infinity. So if you put this thing at infinity. Now, the thing that's strange here is if you look at it this way, it doesn't really mean that this optic looks infinitely big. Because the way you really think of it is, what angle does it subtend? That's sort of how big it seems to you. So it's really these angles that are most important in terms of what its magnification seems like.
So I'll let you play with problems on those to figure most of that stuff out.
In terms of optical instruments, though, what you do is you use the eyepiece as a magnifier to give you sort of the final image. So what we just looked at on the last page is this right-hand piece. So I have an object here, the image of this lens, and you then have the eyepiece for the telescope, which basically then gives you the magnified image that you perceive. This image is created by the so-called objective, which has to be very big if you want to collect a lot of light from some astronomical object. And then it forms an image very close to the focal point of this lens itself, so that you can get a big image here. This is an example of where you have multiple lenses in the system. And the image of this one is the object of that one when you want to calculate what the power of the telescope is. It turns out that if you want to do astronomical research, which means you want to have this be as big as you can make it so that you're collecting light from all over, it turns out that this becomes really hard to do because it becomes very big, and to have glass be perfect and give you no aberrations and things, it's very hard, very heavy and everything. So about the biggest one that is out there, practical, this is a person, if you can see right here, is this 40-inch refractor. So 40 inches would be a 40-inch diameter lens, so whatever it is, something like that. Big lens, but that's about the biggest anyone's ever succeeded in making.
So what you do if you want to make something more powerful is you actually collect the light with the mirror. Now this brings up another topic. In your book, you will have a chapter which is on spherical mirrors. Spherical mirrors can do basically the same kind of stuff that thin lenses can do. They have conventions just like thin lenses, and you have to figure them out. I am not going to cover them. I am not going to test you on them. The MCATs probably will. So you will want to figure it out. But if you can figure out thin lenses, you can figure out mirrors, which is why I'm not worrying about it. Okay? So you may have to figure that out. At any rate, a way to build a large optical telescope is you have a big mirror, which turns out to be easier to build than a big converging lens. And the light comes in and it bounces off the mirror and forms an image here, which you then magnify with an eyepiece. And there are different geometries you can use. For example, this type, or a type where it light comes out through the back. You can build big mirrors. It turns out to, again, start to be very difficult and very heavy to do that. One of the things people have learned to do is to make a very big mirror out of a lot of little small mirrors that you literally can move around to get the focus just right. They actually now make mirrors with little power elements underneath, little elements underneath that can distort the mirror on the fly. And from this, they're actually able to correct out optical distortions that you'll get from variations in the temperature and wind and stuff in the atmosphere that causes the light to have different index of refraction as it comes, so it bends a little bit, so that can cause distortions in the images. And they can now take many of those distortions out on the fly. Anyway, so you can get some pretty fabulous images. You guys have grown up. Okay, that's telling me I need to get on to the exam, so I'll do that in just a second.
Microscopes might be more near and dear to your heart, where you do the same kind of game, but you take something very small here and you form an image near the focal length of this eyepiece and you create a very big image.
So it is these multiple lens instruments that are often very useful. Camera is a real camera, if you do a cutaway, has a very complicated lens system that you're trying to take out all these various distortions. And very often you're making it so that you can move these things around to do the zooming and etc. There's some interesting effects that you can get. But maybe I won't bore you with that right now. We're not going to do anything with cameras on the test. But there's a section in your book you can read if you want. Any questions on this? Okay. So I recognize everyone would benefit from us doing 100 problems with thin lenses and things like that. I think we should all do that. I don't want to be there. So I'm going to let you do it. I don't mean to be obnoxious, I just can't take the time to do that. Because we have other things we need to do. Alright, so just a bit about the exam. There's the grade distribution, the mean was 74. Was a very nice distribution. I think we tucked away the tail rather nicely. So I'm not big on telling you exact grade point lines, but just give you a sense that here this is really a pretty normal mean sort of Gaussian distribution. So this one's pretty nice. And typically that would mean that B is sort of centered about right here. Fairly broad, so the bulk of this is sort of in the B, maybe some B plus over here, a little B minus over here, something like that. A lot of this is sort of A minus. Maybe the B is a little broader than what I said, but just to give you some sense of what's going on. This is much nicer, and then it looks like there's less things where clearly there are big issues. Same advice as before, the solutions are up there. I would like you to look through the solutions, even if you did pretty well, and try to understand what you can about how you did. So everything will be covered again on the final, so you do want to fill any holes that you happen to have that are demonstrated that you have by your test. The other thing is to look for any mistakes that may have been made, and if so, the regrade rules are on the web, and I'm happy to look at things for you. The other thing is, if you didn't do as well as you would like, your very best diagnostic for figuring out how to do better is to try to think your way through what didn't go well on this test and ponder why. And again, I have a bit of a troubleshooting guide on the web that may help you think through that, and I'm happy to talk to you if you'd like. You can bring your test and come in and talk to me about it. Anyway, so let me put these out for you.